The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay. Well, welcome tonight. A very special lecture for me tonight. In more ways than I can express. This is the last of my lectures, but I look forward to your lectures coming up. I really do. I've heard from the TS and from what I've seen from talking to many of you, this is going to be a really amazing set of projects this year, more than any other year. Anyway, last week we asked, what can biology do for computing? And this week is going to be a little less nuts and bolts than usual. The entire course, as you all understand, you're all self-selected to like survey courses, or at least this one, because you're still here. And tonight's going to be more of a survey than ever before, and it's going to be talking about topics for which we don't have answers. And for the most part, there'll be some interesting details along the way. But anyway, instead of what computing can biology can do for computing, this is more about what biology and computing can do for the world. That's really what we want to do. And also, sort of the higher level network models that we can build, since this is network number three. So we'll start out, we've been talking mainly about cellular models as our highest level of networking, and so we'll talk about multicellular models. In particular, the sort of multicellular models that you get that involve sensory integration, integration of higher levels. And then multi-organ, all the way up to multi-organ systems, where we'll take an example sort of from the atomic scale all the way up to organ system failure, and then we'll go from there. Okay. So let's start with multicellular models, and this is something that I'll show you a few slides that will remind you of the first lecture. They either were taken from the first lecture, or in this case, this is a wildly different author and approach and so forth, but it's the same lesson as from the first lecture, which is we not only have these exponential curves going from the 1900s, but they're super exponential. They go up, and the trend lines you get depend on which set of points you use, the steepest one being the most recent one, 1995. And this basically is part of when it is that we will have computing power that might be on the order of an integrated human neural net. We talked about neural nets last time kind of as a metaphor or as an algorithm, but when will we actually have a computer that has the capability of the human cerebral cortex or entire integrated nervous system? And the basis of those calculations that Moravec made and in lecture one, Kurzweil was the super exponential curve I showed. Moravec made them based on his studies on how the retina works. And I think those of you who have done a lot of computer programming, the understanding how the retina works is probably one of the more intuitive of our various human senses, in the sense that you can kind of program an algorithm that might do, in the lower right of slide four here, edge or motion detection. You know, when a frog sees a fly, black and white, go high contrast, zoom across his visual field, something goes off. And you could write an algorithm that could do that, given a few frames of any kind of format. So anyway, but there's been quite a literature on the subject, and when you go through even the best algorithms right now for doing these kind of calculations, and you figure out how long it takes to do... the retina is doing about 10 million detections per second, and then you scale up from that 0.02 gram chunk of retina up to the 1,500 gram human brain, then you kind of get the extrapolation that was in the previous slide. I think this is interesting both as an introduction to the kind of algorithms we'd like to think about when we think about integrating a multicellular system, but also in terms of where the compute power, both biological and computational, is going. Do we want to engineer biological systems to keep up with the silicon or whatever other computational system we're using a decade or so from now. Now, so I said that the visual system is a relatively intuitive computational system to program. In contrast, I would say the olfactory system is less intuitive, at least for me. We know now quite a bit about the molecular biology of the system. There are 1,000 receptors. This is probably one of the largest classes of genomic repeated proteins. And these receptors are in the same family as the receptors that are the major class of drug receptors, the G protein coupled receptors. And there is basically one receptor per cell, which is quite a trick, right? Because you got one receptor from mom and one from dad, and you've got thousands of receptors. But there's basically one per cell. And they detect olfactory molecule concentrations over about 7 logs, where the concentration where they can detect a concentration threshold with a particular standard deviation. Now, this is the beginnings of the model. It's just stating the facts that you know about it. You've got, when you look at the neuroanatomy, you've got this the odorant molecules down at the very bottom of this figure. Cilia, olfactory neurons, which is the primary signal transduction. This then goes up where it's integrated in the glomeruli. And you can think of this sort of like the neural nets we were talking about last time, where you had these interneurons, you had the extra layer that we showed was so important. And the thing that's amazing about the system are lodged in these 4 basic olfactory facts, which I take from Hopfield's work, which is really just like this. It's the same Hopfield that introduced us to really championed the concept of neural nets as a computational algorithmic metaphor. And here, the idea is you have odor and memory recognition. You have background elimination, as just like how your eyes adapt to a mostly red room, your nose is great, or your whole olfactory system is great at adapting to background odorants. So you have one known and one unknown thoroughly mixed. Number 3, you can have component separation. You can have a few different odors at once. You have odor separation where you have unknowns. And each of these tasks, the combination of these is quite remarkable. So the basis of the model that Hopfield has proposed and is this. You have a coverage for each of the I receptors, where I goes from 1 to 1,000. This will vary depending on the organism. Mice have twice as many as we do, probably, so on. But the coverage of each of those receptors is equal to the minimum coverage for the concentration of the target, where the target is the target odorant that you're looking for, over the concentration that's the threshold for firing that neuron for that target, threshold in T. Then you multiply that times either 1 or some fraction. It's 1 if you've really hit the target, and it's this fraction of for that particular receptor and that particular target, you've got some crosstalk. And the amount of crosstalk, you can think of this as a field of receptors, which are all have variable binding. And that binding is over these 6 or 7 logs here. And this just reflects that same thing that we were talking about. And then, so the total number of inputs going to the next layer in the neural net, the coverage here, is going to be the sum of this target signal plus the background signal. So the first term is target, and the right-hand term is the background. And as you can see, they have the same form, the same threshold and concentration. C sub B is concentration of the background. And then Okay. Now, so let's see how this plays out when you actually try this out in a olfactory processing problem. Here you have an odor space, and what you have here is 80 different neurons is the y-axis at the top of slide 7. And then across the bottom, the x-axis is time in milliseconds going from 0 to 800 milliseconds. And this is all modeled on fairly realistic parameters based on experiments. And so what you have here is 80 adapting neurons, and what you're doing is two sniffs of a mixed odor. That's what this is modeling. Okay. First, you have a 100 to 500 milliseconds, the range from, you can see that something's happening at 100 milliseconds, and up to 500, you have a mixed odor, which is 50 parts of X plus 1,000 parts of Y, or 1,000 times Y. And then at 500 milliseconds, you change this ratio very slightly, you see, just up X by 75 and Y up to from 1,000 to 1,100. Okay. So that's the paradigm. 50 and 1,000 to 75 and 1,100. And then sniff at 100 milliseconds, that first one, that mixed odor, it activates more than half the neurons. So this is not like your retina, where if you have a single point source, it'll activate that one rod cell, or maybe a center surround sort of effect. But it's really activating half of the neurons, okay? And then the change sniff at 500 milliseconds, remember just these two small changes, is almost invisible, right? So that's what you're seeing right here, okay? Is this huge swamping amount. But then in B, so that's what happened in A. B, you've now plotting instead of individual neurons, you're doing the instantaneous rate in hertz. Okay? And now when you can see the second sniff here at the 500 milliseconds, which even though you really can't see it in the corresponding point where you're looking at all these individual neurons. And so you can see that even a 20% spread in one of these parameters is enough to get this kind of easily detectable signal. Now that's the example of a simulation. That's not a simulation of a particular experimental data set, but it's based on experimental data sets. And the code, this is not Mathematica, this is MATLAB, which we could have interchangeably taught in this course. And you can see here in green are the comments, and you can see some of the things that we've been talking about here. The number of receptor types is actually here, 2,000 instead of 1,000. You see the target, remember I said, could be some random number that goes over six logarithms. Well, the way that's done here is here's a random number generated, and you generate as the log of the target, and then you get the target by taking the exponential. It's very straightforward, and the code goes on from there. Okay. Now, this brings us to a very interesting point, since these three lectures on networks, and in a certain sense the whole course, is building towards systems biology network models. And for these models to be useful, in the same sense that the models we had for X-ray crystallography and the models we've had for genome interpretation in terms of homology and sequence folding and so forth, need it to be shared. It's the models, even more than the data, need to be shareable, because in a certain sense, even modest manipulation of the data usually involves some good model behind it. And so these are some of the groups that are working on different modeling schemes. In particular, I should point out the BioSpice is now DARPA BioSpice, and SBML is kind of a growing part of that. System Biology Markup Language is a way of sharing this data. And as yet, there's not the kind of convention that we have in crystallography and DNA sequencing, where you submit, at the time that you publish a paper, you submit your data and model data/model with an accession number to the database, or else you don't get it published. We're nowhere near that now for the rest of biology. But these kind of efforts probably are moving in that direction. And you can see that the features of each of these are some of the things that we've been talking about before. You've got stochastic modeling, kinetic modeling, enzyme receptor, sort of cell geometry, neural nets, and so on. This is by no means comprehensive, and there are hypertext links here if you really want to dig into them. And some of the platforms that they've been thinking about, different ways of making it slightly less system dependent. Everyone has, you know, their attempts. Obviously, Windows is not system independent. Okay, so that's two very brief examples of multicellular models, both of them being neural models, kind of building from what we were thinking about last time. But now we're going to a completely different kind of multicellular model, all the way up from sort of individual effects that a single nucleotide, how much effect a single nucleotide can have on a whole organ system, which in this case will be cardiovascular. So we go from... And there are a number of physiome and cardiome projects that are of active interest. These, just like the previous slides that I showed, showing all the ways of sharing system models, many of these efforts are kind of loose consortium alliances where people have put together different models, either deal with the anatomy, physiology, or sometimes a integration of molecular to cellular, cellular to say neural or muscular, and all the way up to fluid dynamics and so on. So let's start with a single base pair change. And I start with this one because you should feel comfortable with it at this point. We mentioned it briefly before. We'll talk about it in more detail now. This is the single nucleotide polymorphism which causes the change of the beta subunit of hemoglobin, which is a tetramer, to go from a glutamate, normally in most people at position 6 of the beta chain, to a valine. Or, so that's the purple set of tetramers, or to tryptophan, and that's the cyan set on the far right. And this, from combinations of X-ray crystallography and three-dimensional modeling, and this is not speculation just based on primary sequence data, even though the primary sequence here is very, very close, just a single nucleotide, a single amino acid change. Nevertheless, these authors have been building this from the crystallographic data, where not only do you care about the tetramer itself, but how the tetramers interact with one another to make these long fibrous chains, which are considerably more stable in the sickle cell. And what you see here is sort of the valine substitution is locked in one kind of conformation and the tryptophan in another, and you can see how these authors have decided how a potential fiber can form in the different cases. Okay. Now those fibers, in one way or another, which is not totally mapped out, but you affect the efficiency of the hemoglobin slightly, and the shape of the cell much more radically, and this combination results in the cell, especially under any kind of stress, either oxidative or other metabolic stress, becoming sickled. So you can have a combination of cells which have varying degrees of sickling here in this microscopic slide on the left. You have both the sickle cell and the normal cell side by side. I think when we built up the red blood cell metabolic model, we talked about some of the non-metabolic considerations of that, which were that this function is to transport oxygen and so forth. And the What we're talking about now is more a cell membrane issue. It's on slide 13, where the internal environment, which is the hemoglobin, is greatly affecting now the external environment, which is the hemodynamic flow in the capillaries. Okay. So this falls under the heading now of how is it that we can go from that single nucleotide change to a very dramatic morphological change. In this case, it's pathological, but you could imagine that in the hands of evolutionary adaptation, an organism could take this and run with it. Maybe not sickle cell mutation, but some other one that causes some other morphological change in some other cell or complex aggregate of cells. Because here you can see a whole variety of different shapes of red blood cells. And remember, these red blood cells are very simple. They have no macromolecular system, no DNA, no RNA. So we're really just talking about a bag of proteins which are greatly affected by these different conditions or enzyme deficiencies. So the system models that were built up where we had the kinetic parameters for the enzymes here can in principle be modeled on the impact it would have on the osmolarity or the other membrane properties that were listed in the previous slide, or the sickling that was in two slides back. Okay. Okay. So from a single nucleotide polymorphism, we've gone to this three-dimensional fiber of hemoglobin to a change in the three-dimensional structure of this biconcave disc to a sickle disc. But you can also go sort of in parallel, the same single nucleotide polymorphism or some like it can take you up to pathogen resistance. We've already mentioned that sickle cell hemoglobin can take you to malarial resistance. But in addition, you can get components of the enzymatic metabolic pathway, such as the one that we modeled two lectures back, such as glutathione peroxidase. This is part of the redox components. And here, erythrocytes that are heterozygous for this particular allele should be more efficient in sheltering the cell membrane from irreversible oxidation and binding hemoglobin caused by the oxidative stress that's exerted by the malarial parasite. And what they observe here is actually an interaction between these two possible haplotypes. So it's actually, you can think of it as a pair of haplotypes. It's the one is the hemoglobin AS, the one we've been talking about, the sickling, and then this glutathione peroxidase. And so what you can imagine is that since both of these things interact with malaria parasite, that your genotype will depend, I'm sorry, your phenotype with respect to malaria will depend on the alleles that you have at both cases. And so you can hear you can have an A over S heterozygote and a 2 over 1 heterozygote. And so that's something to take into account when you're trying to do any kind of predictive modeling or modeling to explain the functional genomics that you have in a patient who's a compound heterozygote like that. So now with the third pathway, same set of single nucleotide polymorphisms that affect either hemoglobin or one of the major enzymes in the red blood cell. Now, one to cell morphology, one to pathogen interaction, and finally to interaction with drugs. We talked about pharmacogenomics. Here's another example where you have the drug-induced oxidative hemolysis that you occur with certain enzymopathies like glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. This enzyme, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase, interacts with drugs such as primaquine, and it disrupts mitochondrial function, heme biosynthesis, and so forth and so on. This is a very significant consideration with a long list of 20-some drugs that has to be taken into account when you have any of a variety of red blood cell enzyme changes. So we've got these three effects of a limited number of single nucleotide polymorphisms. How do you make this transition from, and they're all somewhat interconnected. Part of the reason it's resistant to malaria is because it's less effective in its cell shape and its ability to transport oxygen and do its metabolism. And same thing with drug sensitivity. How are these changes in the hemoglobin, might they be reflected in the three-dimensional shape of the erythrocyte, which is a kind of a membrane-bound compartment? And here's a model that struck me as interesting. It's not been that extensively tested since 1998. But the idea is that band 3, this is one of those names that just comes out of the molecular biologist literature, that they ran a gel and they count the bands and number 3. And it turns out it's about 10% of the red blood cell membrane. It's a very abundant protein. And it's responsible for the equilibration of anions, such as carbonate and chloride, across the red blood cell membrane. It's not a pump, it just kind of allows these anions to go across, because the pump here is the pumps that are involved in proton, and there's also sodium potassium. And that's what your ATP in the red blood cell is going for. And these are just kind of following along. Now the idea here is that if you change the degree, let's see, I think this is covered in more detail. The mechanism of action here is greatly affected by its disulfide effects. If you change the redox components in the red blood cell, you get a slight change in conformation of this molecule, and then that can result in a net difference between the cross-sectional area of this protein on the outside and the inside, which translates into a net change since the phospholipids don't exchange, or the rate constant for the phospholipid exchange is slow and known, then this results in a conformational change. Anyway, that's the model. That connects the single nucleotide to the three-dimensional structure of the cell. Then you want to connect the three-dimensional structure of the cell to its ability to carry out its function in the capillaries. And the function there is to allow the fusion of oxygen and carbon dioxide. And so, here, each of these cells is shaped by a mechanical process. And the mechanical process here, you can take the known or the measurable mechanical properties of a red blood cell and subject them to a method called finite elements analysis, where you're solving these partial differential equations, and you can calculate the exchange of the oxygen, the alveolar just refers to, this would be in the lungs, this would be a small capillary in the lungs. And you can see the capillary now, endothelial walls are close enough so that the red blood cells are basically deformed in their shape as they go through there. And the exact shapes that are compatible with this will determine the rate, these little arrows that go from the oxygen on the outside and the lung epithelium get through the red blood cell. So that's a reference that deals with that kind of problem. Now, once as we start thinking about building up a larger system model, the other parts of the system, each of them, so we've got a red blood cell model, it's a metabolic model. In principle, it could also be a shape model and a diffusion model. But the other parts of the system typically involve muscle cells. They have the smooth muscles throughout the entire arterial and venous system, and most significantly, the heart muscles. And so here you have an example of action potential in one of the ventricular cells of the dog heart, and it includes all the components that at least we, since this is not an entire course on ventricular heart modeling, this is the sort of parameters in terms of all the I's, the currents for each of the different potassium channels, the K, each of the ones with I sub K result potassium, and then there's some that are sodium and calcium, potassium, sodium alone. You see each of these things. You have internal stores of calcium that go from one subcellular compartment to another, and so on. You get the idea. Each of these things has to have the parameters measured, and any of that are absent, you have to have reasonable ways of getting surrogates. And so this is just the sort of data that would go into the other major type of cell that comes into this cardiovascular modeling. And finally, you can integrate this up to a fairly complete system. It's obviously not complete until you get to the whole organism, but higher level. And we're talking about whole body recirculation. This NSR group, this is the hypertext link for this particular model, which you can download. And it has a four-chambered heart. We were just talking about one ventricular cell on the previous slide. But that would be, if we look at the second box from the top here, this is where the heart and lung model would fit in there. It's got seven different organs, which include kidney, liver, gut, lower limbs, and so forth down at the bottom part of the diagram. And you get the picture. Each of these things, you're modeling the volumes and flows. Okay. Now, this is systems biology. This is really kind of a renaissance of interest in physiology, is what it would have been called before. And there are some really interesting mysteries out there to be solved that are really only solvable or possibly only solvable at the system level. You know, you never know. Somebody could come up and say, "Oh, yeah, this is really well understood immunology, and that answers everything." But even if it's some kind of immunology, you still have to say, "How does it play out?" And what happens is, we've been talking about sickle cell disease, and you can have fairly mild pain as one of the major symptoms. But then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you'll get this multi-organ system failure, where you know, almost every major organ in that previous slide, lungs and so forth, fill up with fluid, and you have a very high chance of dying. And this can happen to every one of us in this room because it's not restricted to sickle cell. If any of you have severe burn or car crash, major bone injuries, so forth, you have a very good chance of getting this multi-organ system failure. And it really isn't known how that plays out. I mean, not just a quantitative model, but even qualitatively. So I think this is something. There are projects now to get genomic data collection, both genetic and expression data, and time will tell whether that is actually the best route to solving that mystery. So that was multi-organ. Now we're talking about multi-organism. Okay. After you've built up an entire organism, then you want to know how it acts at the next level of network analysis, which is how does it fit in with other organisms? None of us, almost no organism, really belongs in an ecological niche all by itself. And some of the modeling we've been talking about in this course could be called simulation. And probably one of the longest-lasting computer games in the world, and one of the most successful, I've heard, is the Sims. So
starting with SimCity in SimCity in 87, and then this particular one illustrated here is SimLife, which is all about ecological modeling, and it's not entirely different from what a serious ecological modeling program would do. It certainly has a lot of the interesting parameters, such as the lifespan. Here, you're doing demographics here, so you have the lifespan, food needed, the size, kind of vision, roaming, so forth, of all these different kinds of animals. You can have you can have plants, you can have herbivores, carnivores, and so on. And then you can set up the population sizes, and then it will do simulations based on that, where each individual animal is tracked in terms of position and quantity, and as you would expect, as the carnivores build up, then they knock down the herbivores, and the plants go up, and so forth, and it goes through these cycles. And so this is basically a stochastic model, just like the stochastic models that we had for molecules, but here at the organism level. And what's happening here in the slower right-hand section is you've got little green plants getting eaten by herbivores, and the herbivores getting eaten by carnivores. Now, hopefully this course has already or will inspire you to really think globally, to think not only globally in terms of how little pieces of molecular tools fit together into systems and networks, but how our systems and networks we model fit into the big picture of what are really important problems. Maybe a slightly improved Viagra is not in the same category as a new tuberculosis drug, or maybe it is. I mean, you decide for yourself what is thinking globally. But you have to act locally, and that's what we're doing in this class. When we're thinking globally and we're thinking about ecological systems, we're thinking about the lithosphere, for the most part, and its interaction with the hydrosphere. The lithosphere is mostly silicon dioxide, tiny bit of carbon, and it gets very hot very quickly. So only the top 0.1%, the top 4 kilometers of it, is survivable in any type of organism we know of. About 110 degrees centigrade is where organisms start having deep field trouble. You and I would have trouble before that. The biosphere here is about 3 times 10 to the 15th grams. My estimate for marine organisms, and maybe 10 to the 18th gram for all land plants and animals and microorganisms. The microbial hydrosphere here is about 10 to the 21st milliliters, which works out about 10 to 27 cells. A phenomenal number of these cells, about 10 to the 26th of those cells, is a single species, which is Prochlorococcus, which is responsible for maybe about 50% of the Earth's photosynthesis. A lot of that photosynthesis does not end up in fixed carbon because it is immediately consumed by one of its other predators, basically. But there's a, there's really quite a lot of cells out there, which, to the extent that they're well mixed, and they're not, of course, it's not perfectly mixed, all the Pacific and Atlantic and so forth, but it's a considerably more well mixed, say, than the lithosphere organisms, where you have organisms down a kilometer into the ground. They don't move around very rapidly. So when you have a population of that size, as you remember from one of our first lectures on population size, the effect of population size determines the rate of drift and the sort of the optimality of the organism. So one of the things that we do when we've been talking about mining the biosphere, one of the things we're looking for are new tools that we can use for nanoengineering. And one of my pet ones that I'm becoming interested in, we don't work on this anything, but this is kind of interesting, is a set of, we mentioned this briefly in the drug protein interaction lecture, where, but I don't think I mentioned this particular one, where you have polyketides that go together. It's another polymer that has certain similarities to the basic polymers we talked about, but each step in it had to have a protein enzyme, an enzymatic domain to accomplish that. And so one of these is tetracycline, and this is one of the more aromatic, kind of coupled aromatic compounds that's made, because you have these cyclases and aromatases in addition to the sort of polymerization steps. And so you make this thing that's it looks kind of like a polyaromatic hydrocarbon. And also in nature, you will find in soot, in forest fires, and all kinds of natural phenomena, you will find polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which some of you may know about as being a potent carcinogen. But they're also just, natural components. But they're also, you can start to see this looks a little bit like the buckyballs and buckytubes that we talked about when we were talking about molecular type transistors. So the possibility of mining the biosphere for enzymes that act to synthesize or degrade this class of compounds, I think, would be just an example. We could list many others, but the part of it is just to dream, to imagine what it is you would like to find out there, and if there's an abundant source of it, then you should be able to, abundant source of, say, the compound in this case, then you should be able to find a microorganism and an enzyme that goes with that, because there's a truly phenomenal amount of diversity. Another very important global consideration, rather than just mining it for new tools, is thinking about ways that either we could engineer or accidentally mess up our entire planet, as we are could be doing with global warming, or could do. And perhaps it's naive to think that we actually are having such a big effect, because we know that global warming changes periodically over millennia. But it is very clear from the record that just exactly how much carbon dioxide we are releasing, and it makes sense that it's consistent with the kind of temperature changes that have been observed since the Industrial Revolution. In any case, when you look at in particular, the Southern Ocean, up at the top of slide 27, you can see there's a few places. In particular, the Southern Ocean seems like it's a prime candidate where you have high nutrients but low chlorophyll. And you say, well, why would you have high nutrients but very little of the chlorophyll around that you would, which is a tip-off that you have the photosynthetic bacteria? And the reason is that you have limitation of some micronutrient. Micronutrient means not needed in the vast quantities that you need, nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon, oxygen, so on. So iron typically is the limiting micronutrient in the Southern Ocean. And so there are actually have been little pilot experiments to drop iron off the backs of huge tankers, and there are now at least 7 patents that have been filed on doing this in order to balance out carbon credits for different nations. This is potentially a very big bit of terrestrial engineering that might happen. It involves trying to change phytoplankton. And as this line here begins to point out, even though phytoplankton are only 1% of the total global biomass, it's about 50% of the carbon fixation. What is the source of this 50-fold anomaly? Why is it that even though it's doing, how is it doing 50% of the carbon fixation? And what's happening is a lot of the carbon is going right back out after being fixed, instead of settling to the bottom of the ocean and never bothering us again, it gets returned. And the exact modeling of that requires a much deeper knowledge of exactly what organisms are present in the ocean. One of the problems with this, however, is the genomic problem in a certain sense, which is that very few of these organisms can be cultivated in a laboratory. On the order of 99.9% of the organisms that you sample from the ocean or from the soil, a number of different environments, do not grow well in the laboratory. So if you were to study them, some people are feeling that the best route to studying them is going directly for looking at their genomes without necessarily being able to grow them in the laboratory. Now, when we talk about this problem of even if we fertilize the oceans and you know we can model this whole procedure, won't go into details, but if there are predators there that take the fixed carbon and turn it back into carbon dioxide, you want to be able to monitor that. Now, of course, the ocean is a large, complex set of prokaryotic autotrophs, that is, say, photosynthetic bacteria and eukaryotic photosynthetic bacteria, and prokaryotic and eukaryotic predators of various sorts. And this is, I think, one of the more interesting predator-prey differential equation models. It's almost the same as many of the other differential equations that we did from the first lecture on growth. We did the logistic equation, some of the ones we did on repressor function, and so on. But the thing that's kind of interesting about this one is it's not simply a single-cell bacteria being eaten by a single-cell heterotroph, let's say a blue-green algae being eaten by a single-cell heterotroph. Here, they're both multicellular. They're sort of the minimal multicellular, but so chlorella is one of the smallest plants, multicellular plants, and Brachyonis is a small rotifer, multicellular animal. Because they're multicellular, though, now you have the demographic mortality and fecundity of each of these things that has to be modeled in. That's the M and the lambda for Brachyonis. And so this plays into these equations where you have here in the upper right, slide 28, the rate of change of nitrogen with respect to time and concentration of chlorella. So nitrogen is N, chlorella is C. The R is the Brachyonis and that are reproducing, and B are the Brachyonis, which are the total. And you can see each of these equations and how it plays out. Now, this is how, and the way they play it out here is you do it by dilution rate delta here. And the dilution rate is shown along the horizontal x-axis for each of these three plots here. And what they're modeling is on the far left, the nitrogen concentration as a function of dilution rate. And you can see you get these different different sectors of behavior. When you look at the chlorella, this is the green, the photosynthetic multicellular organism, in units of millions of cells per milliliter, that can take different. It can take different pathways here, where as a function of dilution rate, you get this bifurcation, where you get a huge split in the possible concentrations of chlorella is the one curve, and the Brachyonis the predator is the other curve. This kind of bifurcation is the sort of thing we talked about earlier in the, both in the logistic equation and in the cell decision modeling. And what in the upper right hand, here's our friend, the coefficient of variation in percent ranging from 0 to 80 or so on the vertical axis, and the dilution rate. And again, you can see that you get a peak in the dilution rate at around 0.75. So these are the bottom two are models, and the upper right is data. that you can actually see when you run real chlorella and Brachionis in here, that you do get a peak, just as you would predict this kind of bifurcation analysis, this kinetic modeling, that's due to where you get interesting behavior in this complicated, or this fairly simple model ecosystem where you just have two species. In the ocean, of course, you have a lot more. Now, that's out in the wide world where you have 10 to the 26 cells. But inside every one of us in this room, no offense, but there are about 10 times as many non-human cells in each of us as there are human cells. And we have our own ecology. And there is a literature where, you know, certain organisms we know cause diseases, and they're put into one category, infectious diseases. But then there's another set that takes some time to sort out, and you can see here are candidate diseases and candidate organisms, and all these little bars that are going in here are references that you can look up, where maybe it's not an airtight case yet, or maybe it's not even, maybe there's controversial or discredited at this point. But these are links where eventually this will be called an infectious disease, Helicobacter pylori causes stomach ulcers. I think that's basically already accepted. Some Australian doctor named Marshall decided to drink a bunch of Helicobacter to prove to his colleagues he didn't believe any stomach ulcers were caused by Helicobacter, much less all of them. And he drank it, he threw himself, he drank it again. And he caused stomach ulcers in himself. And hopefully none of you will volunteer to do similar things with some of these other nasty guys here, because I think some of the list of things that they cause are a little more serious than stomach ulcers, and the cures are a little less obvious than the cures for a gram-negative bacterium like Helicobacter. There have been various efforts started to actually mine, you know, what's the connection with genomics and computational biology, to mine the transcriptome for evidence of these. You can look for bacteria very easily because they have ribosomal RNA components, which you can PCR. Viruses are more complicated because they're not conserved, or they don't have any universally conserved element like ribosomal RNA. But there have been efforts to take, look for what's present in the human transcriptome that's not present in the human genome. Human genome is something, you know, highly purified and cloned and so forth. Well, the transcriptome is, you know, it's whatever cells they ground up that day. And indeed, lurking in there are many of these hepatitis, papilloma, Epstein-Barr virus, retroviral-like elements, which are not present in the human genome as yet. Human genome is not completely finished, so that's still a escape clause. But basically, these are smoking guns for at least commensals. Microorganisms and viruses that are living in tissues, and some of them may be tissue-specific. Some of them, subset, may actually cause disease, and that's the whole problem, then, is sorting out cause and effect. We know how it's been done heroically with Helicobacter pylori, but how do we do it with the other ones? Some of them will have tissue culture models. At the time this slide was done, so this is just illustrating kind of the flow of nucleic acid information that comes in about that was capable of being mined for new microorganisms, new viruses that might be present in a tissue-specific fashion, might be pathogens. This is some of the most popular sequences that are from which we're mining. Obviously, human was popular at the time this was done because human genome was in place. Here's Brachionis, our friend, which was pretty high up on this list, considering most of you probably didn't hear about Brachionis before this lecture. Now you've heard of it twice. It just was a spurt in sequencing interest. And, of course, HIV is the winner year after year because of the importance of resequencing it for new mutations. And it really has a record number of new mutations. And we've talked about HIV from a variety of different standpoints. One of them, you know, is polymerase. its protease, its drug targets, and its source of drug resistance.
And that you can follow up that model, you know, that sort of atomic scale protein modeling, where you're looking for new drugs that won't,
where the polymerase, the mutant polymerase, will not be resistant to new drugs.
But you can also monitor the population scale as HIV goes through a particular patient or through a population of patients. How does the drug resistance change as a function of time? Here, the horizontal axis is in days, up to 30 days, and then the vertical axis is the the titers of the viruses, and you can see it as a function of time. And what you have here is rates of exponential increase. These are on logarithmic scales, and where you're modeling such thing is the clearance to the immune system and so forth. Originally, this virus was thought to be a very slow virus, very slowly replicating virus, almost cryptic, and then later was found out this is actually a very rapidly replicating, but an immune system that's very rapidly responding. The sort of model, just each of these models we've gone through has a set of parameters that goes along with it. In a certain sense, there's quite a bit you can learn about a model just by seeing what parameters are present or absent, whether they're experimentally determined, how accurately, and so on. And sort of model parameters here are mortality rate of uninfected CD4 plus T cells, same thing for infected cells. You know, they're going to have differential mortality. You can see on the far right that there's a huge difference between the guy at quarter per day versus 5,000, and so on. There's rates for getting infected, rates of virus loss, production, threshold value for remission, so on and so forth. And these are important parameters for how the virus population changes within a person or the population. How it spreads through the population depends on, in many cases, on the herd immunity and so forth. And we get into issues of public health. It's almost a truism that most of the additional quality years of life, quality adjusted life years here, QALY, that we have in the world, the fact that, you know, our life expectancy is so much longer and so forth, are mainly public health decisions that have been made, not so much pharmaceutical. Such things as clean water have made a huge impact. And so we need to think, but even when you think about the pharmaceutical aspects, it needs to be thought in a public health sense. And a surprising amount of public health officials in even the most developed nations, maybe most of them, do not have formal education in public health. And so I urge you all to get at least some education in this. Because in this we have, you know, here, they're trying to build and have built quantitative models, not only for the kinetics which a disease will go through a population or through even through an individual, but the way that you make decisions. And this is having an impact on the way decisions are, how these different projects are prioritized. At any given time, you might have hundreds of different candidate vaccines, which is one of a major, very effective public health strategy. And this is the way they prioritize it. So that level one saves money and it improves life. So that's almost a no-brainer. And then you have different levels where you have might cost $10,000 or $100,000 per quality adjusted life year saved. So the level one candidates are cytomegalovirus and therapeutic vaccines, which these are not aimed at an infectious disease, but diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, various bacterial ones.
Of course, HIV was not even in this study because it was such a high priority already within the NIH. Okay. So is there a role for genomics and computational biology, the title of this course, in this vaccine research and development? I think the answer is yes, but it requires a great deal of creativity and resourcefulness on all of your parts. There are new opportunities with DNA vaccines that, where you can have one or more DNAs shot intramuscularly or a variety of other ways. What is delivered by the DNA vaccine can be various so-called intracellular vaccines, which can either act through cell-mediated immunity or in some other way intracellularly. RNAi is a rapidly emerging way of delivering things that may not be classically considered therapeutics or vaccines. The concept of multiplexing, many of us have received multiple vaccines at a time. Typically, every year, your flu vaccine will have two or three strains in it. But as you can see from this middle article, the diversity of certain diseases like HIV and influenza almost demand attention to genomics, the diversity that can occur either from year to year or throughout the entire global set of viruses. Another opportunity is when we have vectors, for say arthropod vectors, insect vectors like mosquito, and we have opportunities to hit malaria at all the different life stages. Not just, there are multiple life stages within humans and multiple stages within within the insect vector. And now the genomics of these two just came out recently in the same week in Nature and Science. This provides a whole new set of inspirations for work that can be done on these. I think we should take a little break now, and we'll wrap up the talk after that break.